Hi, this is Elmore Leonard. I'm listening to Film Sociology, and it's a real program. It's great.
It's time to hear what's good, what's bad, and what's ugly at the multiplex and the art house. What's new on video and streaming, and you might also hear about some dead people we like.
We don't have time for dead people we don't like.
Anyway, this is Film Sociology, where you'll find out what's the next cinematic marvel.
It was unbelievable!
And what's just a movie.
Shut up! My God, you have no freaking life!
Okay, here's your host and my dad, Matthew Soucy.
Hello there, film lovers. Welcome to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. If you have a question or a comment, you can email me at msocey, that's M-S-O-C-E-Y, at WFYI.org. I'm also on Facebook, also on Twitter, at Matthew Soucy. The show is available on iTunes, and like all of the podcasts here at WFYI, available on Spotify. Well, friends, we got through another week. We'll grab a pencil in a little bit. Hope you got to see some movies that were new and good, or new, good films that are new, or at least new to you, as well as falling back on old favorites. So we'll grab a pencil in a little bit. We'll go around the horn. Of course, the Heartland Film Festival is coming up. That is running October 6th through the 16th. So you can go to heartlandfilm.org for more information and how to get tickets over there. Hoping to get somebody from the festival on the show, hopefully next week. Of course, Lysistrata with Indie Bard Fest also opens on October 6th. So IndieBardFest.com for tickets and information. I'm hoping to get somebody on the show for that. But I want to start this week with paying tribute to classic Hall of Fame that guy, character actor, or as Mrs. Soucy likes to say, all actors are character actors. But Henry Silva, who is 9 days shy of his 96th birthday, died on September 14th at the age of 95. And looking at his bio, was of Sicilian and Spanish descent, born and raised in Brooklyn, which explains a lot. That meant in the 1950s, you played a lot of different ethnicities, because that's what Hollywood did back then. And this is another example of a guy, of an artist, who the artist and the audience have different paths. Like, there's like snowflakes, they're like fingerprints. No two are alike. Your discovery of Henry Silva is different than my discovery of Henry Silva. And I love to tell the story. First thing I noticed Henry Silva in was playing the drug-addicted assassin in Burt Reynolds' Sharky's Machine. That was the film I got to see on my 12th birthday with my father and my grandmother, who counted the curse words. And it's the only time I ever said to my grandmother, "Is that all you got out of the film?" And I didn't get hit in the head. So the plight, the connection of the character actor is you see a performance that captures your interest. And then you see them somewhere else and you go, "Hey, it's that guy." And soon after, it was like 3 years after, I saw Silva make fun of his tough guy image in another Burt Reynolds film, Cannonball Run 2. And then he just started kind of popping up. He was Chuck Norris's nemesis in Code of Silence. He was the first villain for Steven Seagal in Above the Law. But anyway, going all the way back to the 1950s as far as credits, and I didn't know, was a member of the Actors Studio, and there was a play that the studio had staged called A Hat Full of Rain, which was later made into a film, and Silva got to be in the film version. So that was kind of cool. But I'm reading Wikipedia now, whatever. Did audition, was accepted. So that's the Michael Gazzo play. So, but early credits include The Tall T, as I mentioned, A Hat Full of Rain, Ride a Crooked Trail, and was Roger Corniel in the original Ocean's 11, and had an uncredited cameo in Steven Soderbergh's Ocean's 11, as did Angie Dickinson, so it kind of comes full circle. Was in Jerry Lewis's Cinderfella, Sergeant's 3, was Kunjin, who has the he has the famous fight scene with Frank Sinatra in The Manchurian Candidate, the film Johnny Cool, which is probably his most noted lead performance. Films like Hail Mafia, yes, in 1965 he played Mr. Moto in The Return of Mr. Moto. The Plainsman, obviously did a lot of television as well. Never a Dull Moment, Man and Boy, and then did a slew of crime and mafia films in Italy in the 1970s. And let's see, Tough Cop, Love and Bullets back here in the States. He was in Buck Rogers in the 25th Century, Day of the Assassin, Alligator, I mentioned Sharky's Machine, of course, Wrong is Right, Megaforce, Chained Heat, Escape from the Bronx, Lust in the Dust, The Violent Breed with a very old Woody Strode, Code of Silence, I mentioned, Bulletproof, Amazon Women on the Moon, Alan Quartermain in The Lost City of Gold, he was in Warren Beatty's Dick Tracy, South Beach, 3 Days to a Kill, he and Williamson worked together. The Silence of the Hams. Don't watch that. The End of Violence and Ghost Dog. Jim Jarmusch's. That was his last speaking role in Ghost Dog: The Way of the Samurai. Mad Dog Time. I mean, just constant working. So and always brought his A game. We like that in our working that guys. So salute to Henry Silva. And because of this, a great excuse to replay my 2012 interview with Mike Malloy, who was the director of the great documentary about Italian cop and mafia films called Eurocrime. And we're going to play that right now. Enjoy. Joining me on Film Sociology right now, the writer, director, editor, and co-producer of the documentary Eurocrime. Who do you think you are, John Sayles? Mike Malloy is here. Hi, Mike.
Hey there. What is the reference? Because I have an exclamation point? Is that it?
No, the writing, directing, editing, co-producing.
See, I see.
Or you're Robert Rodriguez. He's another one who edits his own work, I believe.
Indeed. Yeah, the editing was a real hitch on this one. A year plus on the editing.
Wow. I would say, so of course, your documentary is about the Italian police and crime movies of the 70s. What was your first Eurocrime movie experience?
Well, that a lot of people ask me, like, what film, you know, pushed me over into Eurocrime obsession. And it didn't happen that way at all for me. I got into these films before I knew they were a genre. I would just see selected, isolated little Italian-made crime films, and it never occurred to me that this was a whole genre. This was something that came after the spaghetti westerns, because the Italians were very fat-oriented, and they would burn something out, and then they'd move on to something else. And after the Italians had ripped off the American western, put on their own spin, and came up with something entirely different, after they exhausted that, they turned to Dirty Harry cop films and The Godfather gangster films, and they did that from like 1972 to 1980. So I was just seeing all these films, and like in college and stuff, people would say, what kind of movies do you like, Mike? And I would tell them why. You know, I like Italian films. I like French films. They thought I probably was watching highbrow stuff like, you know, The 400 Blows or something like that. And meanwhile, I was watching these, shoot-'em-ups with all these grisly murders in them.
And they always had, usually an American or English star and a director, and it's usually listed directed by Nick Jones. You're like, that doesn't sound right.
Yeah, sometimes they would anglicize the directors' names or something like that, but that happened more with the spaghetti westerns. By the time the Eurocrime films came around, people pretty much knew that they were getting an Italian product out of Italy. But the Eurocrime films didn't penetrate the U.S. like the spaghetti westerns did, so that's why now, you know, this revival movement that kind of spurred me to do the documentary, 30 years belated, these films are finally, resonating with American audiences.
So I guess I'll try a different approach on what were the films that did motivate you to start this documentary?
Oh, there are a number of them. The thing is that, there's so many different cuts and there's so many different titles. Like there's one that I love called Rome Armed to the Teeth, but I only recommend it in its Assault with a Deadly Weapon incarnation I don't know, they just lopped off the first 20 minutes and made it a much better film under the title Assault with a Deadly Weapon. But some of the ones that have been available for streaming on Netflix that people can easily see are things like Caliber 9 and Street Law. Street Law is a great vigilante film, and there's some debate as to, because everybody just assumes that the Italians are the ripoff of us. But there's some debate as to whether Street Law came out before Death Wish. They both are 1974 films.
Right. And I say, as you point out in the documentary, one of the things that the Italians did to make it their own was the amount of violence and cruelty, I mean, misogynistic cruelty and sex scenes in it. Was that from the get-go?
Yeah, the Italians did not have the same puritanical influences that American cinema did, or the American cinema was, you know, shedding by that time, but still had the last vestiges of the Italian cinema. You know, the main thing that I see difference as far as their boundaries of violence is the Italians almost delighted in killing kids. And that still, in American cinema, was a big taboo. But, yeah, there would be, like, there's one movie where there's a bunch of kids getting out of school, and they happen upon the scene of a bank robbery. So this whole school's worth of kids round this corner, right as some, you know, bank robber with an itchy trigger finger just, you know, is ready to down people. And he does exactly that. It's just unbelievable the carnage where kids are concerned.
It's funny you mentioned that, because last year, I don't know if you ever saw Hobo with a Shotgun, but they have a whole school bus gets torched up, filled with kids.
Yeah, as I say, North American cinema, I know that was Canadian, but North American cinema has finally kind of shed some of those boundaries, but the Italians were, you know, a good 30 years ahead of us.
And one of the things that was brought up, and I know Fred Williamson brought this up, about how American audiences and some American actors were kind of pampered as far as getting the best and the biggest budgets, and the fact that, you know, he was shooting movies there where they didn't even stay quiet during shooting. And, you know, a lot of it was dubbing later, but it was a completely different shooting environment.
Yeah, you kind of bring up two different things. The one, they did not shoot live sound, so that was an adjustment for American actors to show up on set, and as they're giving their line deliveries, yeah, the sets are being built next door, and people are pounding with hammers, and people are out ordering their cappuccino and, you know, stuff like that. So, yeah, that was a big adjustment. But then also something that Fred Williamson, the American star, alluded to is the fact that, you know, you show up and there's no star egos in an Italian crew. There was no barriers. There was no hierarchy on set. Everybody was just there to make a movie. And, maybe the only ego or macho thing was the Italians. Everybody wanted to perform their own stunts. The big leading stars, you know, it was just expected that, you know, this was a manly, you know, tough guy movie. Of course I'm going to, you know, jump out of the car myself. Of course I'm going to jump out of the second-story building myself. The French actor Jean-Paul Belmondo, big international star, you know, became a star with the French New Wave movies, you know, these dramas. But by the time the Eurocrime movies rolled around in the 70s, he went full bore into performing the stunts. I don't even know how they got insurance for those movies.
Did they have insurance, I guess, is the question.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one aspect that I've never really delved into, but these movies are so run and gun, you know, with the, you know, they not only did they get the leading men to perform their own stunts, but they would just go out in public and what they called stealing shots. You know, they would just go and perform, you know, shootouts on the open public streets, and people just were assuming that, you know, this was, you know, they were seeing some bank heist in progress and stuff. So it was very easy to get the extras to act naturally.
Well, and there was a little bit of that. I mean, there still is in the United States. I mean, we've heard stories of Cassavetes and early Kubrick doing such things, but not to the degree of these guys. And, of course, it also helped that a lot of the Italian filmmakers also had to deal with a lot of the local quote-unquote characters.
Yeah, especially down in southern Italy and areas like Naples. The street people were a major influence, and, you know, there would be beggars on the corners and stuff, and if you wanted to shoot on that corner, then you had to pay the beggar what he thought he was going to make for the day and stuff like that. So in some ways it was a minor hassle to shoot down in southern Italy, but in another way it was just the filmmakers were tremendously liberated to just go out and do whatever, and they didn't feel beholden to scripts either. You know, they would pass a unique location and they're like, let's just change it from a scene at the beach to a scene at the church. Mm-hmm. You know, so, yeah, it's just they were very spontaneous. And that's what a lot of the actors and directors looking back say, yeah, these films were extremely low budget, but they had, you know, just such a life to them because of the spontaneity, and they're such unpredictable. And today's movies, you know, you see them and, you know, as one interviewee said, you almost know when the car's going to explode before it explodes. Mm-hmm. And the Italian films just, things came at you crazy-like, and you just didn't know what to expect.
Now, yeah, a lot of the actors did say if there was still business, they would not only do business in Italy but also live there. What happened?
Well, the first decline in Italian cinema happened at the end of the Eurocrime boom, coincidentally. It had nothing to do with Eurocrime, but that's when, belatedly, the Italians started getting more television, because up till that point, they'd only had about 1.5 channels, and there was a very big restriction on how many movies could be shown on TV. So the Italians went to the cinema maybe 4 or 5 times a week, you know, kind of like we tune into stuff on TV 4 or 5 times a week. By the mid-70s, they finally started getting TV. They got satellites and, you know, antennas and stuff, and started to bring in stuff from other countries. And so the film industry went into sharp decline then. They kept on through the 80s. They turned to Mad Max ripoffs. They turned to Indiana Jones ripoffs. But, you know, by the end of the 80s, it had wound down even more.
Yeah, I remember Fred Williamson with a bow and arrow and shoulder pads and a headband, and that equaled the future.
Yeah, that was their version of Mad Max. Mad Max, and then throw in a little dash of Escape from New York, and that's what the Italians were obsessed with in the 80s.
Now, you also, one of the things that's most impressive about Eurocrime are the number of people you were able to get to sit down and talk. How many people did you talk to, and how long did it take to get everybody?
I think we talked to 21 people that made the doc, and then some came kind of afterwards that we hope to be including as DVD supplements or something like that. I had never, during the production of this whole thing, I had never left the country. I've never been to Italy. I've never been to Rome. The interviews that we picked up in Rome a great guy named Federico Cadeo happens to shoot DVD supplements for the big cult DVD labels over in Europe, and he would, you know, drop a line to me and say, hey, I'm shooting an interview and so-and-so, do you want me to piggyback some Eurocrime questions on? So that worked out beautifully.
And how many actors and filmmakers did you personally interview?
7 to 9, I think. You know, this was a real no-budget affair, you know, with, you know, basically fueled by fan support. So, you know, we got some money on Kickstarter by the fans and everything. So when I could limit my travel, I did. I, you know, tried not to be egotistical and to think that I needed to be there. I wrote all the questions for all the interviews, but I didn't feel as if I needed to be there in person if I had someone trusted that could, you know, set up the camera in my place.
Okay, big geeky question. What was it like to interview Franco Nero?
Franco Nero was very, very cool, but we kind of surprised him. I drove down to Miami, and he was there for a film festival, and I made a deal with the guy who put him up. And Franco Nero, I come into the house with the camera crew and everything, and Franco Nero was actually coming out of a hidden door in a false bookcase. How surreal is that? And he looks up, and there's a film crew in the living room where he's staying. So, yeah, that was my first time laying eyes on Franco Nero.
Well, and the fact that the man's still working today, decades later, and of course, you know, started out in spaghetti westerns and moved on to Eurocrime when he wasn't wooing Guinevere.
Right. He's remained very relevant. All this Django Unchained stuff aside, yeah, he was recently in an episode of Law and Order. He was, you know, in that Letters to Julia thing.
Yep.
So he's staying very relevant, and I'm very pleased because, you know, he's a tremendous movie star.
Now, did you see or were aware of the documentaries Not Quite Hollywood, Machete Maidens Unleashed when making this?
Yeah, the Eurocrime, again, this was not like Not Quite Hollywood, which I presume had Australian Cultural Commission dollars behind it. This was just one guy. I started the documentary in my living room. I had to finish it in the upstairs of my girlfriend's parents' house because it cost me my ability to pay rent even.
Mm-hmm.
So this was just, you know, and I hate to say I was a one-man army because that doesn't do credit to the people who, you know, volunteered. I had a volunteer narrator. I had a volunteer animator. So I don't want to ever, you know, slight those people. And, you know, as I mentioned, the cameramen and stuff who helped me. But, yeah, this was – so I actually started before Not Quite Hollywood. But, that stuff came out while I was still putting the finishing touches on mine.
By the way, One Man Army sounds like a Franco Nero film in 1978.
Why can't it be a Franco Nero movie in, you know, 2012?
Well,
we established he's still a movie star.
Well, good. You talk to him then. I'll review it then.
Sounds good.
So, Mike, if people, besides wanting more information, let's start with, for more information on how to find your documentary, what should folks do?
The big gathering place now is on Facebook, facebook.com/Eurocrime.
Okay. And if folks were trying to do Eurocrime 101, what films should they start with?
Well, yeah, the ones that, and I think that some of them just came off Netflix Instant, but the ones you can start with that have been available for a long time on Netflix have been The Italian Connection, Caliber 9, Street Law. Those are three solid, because I think that the core of Eurocrime movies are, you know, kind of this one man against the world kind of theme, and I think all three of those embody that pretty well.
Well, Mike, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you for your interest.
From 2012, that's Mike Malloy, the writer and director of the great documentary Eurocrime, which was about Italian cop and mob films. And I don't say this very often, that's a film that could be longer. And I know there, and on the DVD there are the full interviews with the likes of Fred Williamson, Franco Nero, Henry Silva, that sort of thing. And yeah, it could be longer. But and from what I've heard, was Henry Silva was just a sweet dude. So I'm happy about that. So once again, salute to Henry Silva. As I mentioned in the titles, and especially in the 80s, I saw him a lot in my multiplex dwelling years. So very cool. Salute, Henry. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Catching up on some video titles. From Film Movement is a Greek drama called Moon 66 Questions, which tells the story of 20-something Artemis who returns to Athens to take care of her ailing father. And so there's a couple aspects to it that I can appreciate, especially with my in-laws in the last few years, watching the daughter and the father try to reconnect. Going through his physical therapy, the fact that every day is different with somebody who is recovering from an ailment. You know, we see her frustration on how the father is great one day and absolutely difficult the next. There is no consistency. And I think that's one that we don't see a lot in films about physical recovery. There is a secret, not going to give it away, but also confronting mom about this. But anyway, it's the daily routine I can really appreciate. And so, yeah, low-key subtle performances, but we're checking out from Film Movement, Moon 66 Questions. Kino Lorber has a slew of older titles that were sent my way. And I know on last week's show I mentioned the Chuck Norris film Good Guys Wear Black, which is I described as missing in action. If you took out the action, there's more talking in that film than missing in action. So it's more the red tape with a few fight scenes. Continuing on with the streak of Chuck Norris films from the late 70s, early 80s, there was also from 1979 A Force of One, a PG film, so take that for what that's worth. Screenplay by Ernest Tiedemann, the man who won an Oscar for The French Connection, the one who created Shaft. I believe I read in research he did this film so he could buy his mother a house. So there is that. And it's I don't know if this was a Chuck Norris vehicle when he wrote it or did they add it in. It's one of those. He shares top billing. Chuck Norris shares top billing with Jennifer O'Neill, for you fans of Summer of 42. Although it cracks me up, there is a moment where Chuck Norris runs a martial arts studio, and he's adopted a 15-year-old son, and he introduces his son to Jennifer O'Neill, and I kept thinking, dude, didn't you see Summer of 42? You don't want to do that. You know how that ends. A number of police officers are killed in a small Los Angeles suburb, and the cause of death seems to be through martial arts. And so the police want to bring Chuck Norris in to help train the police officers in martial arts and maybe try to give a perspective on it. Now, I'm surprised Tinnaman didn't also lean in a little bit more on could Chuck Norris be one of the suspects, but I guess he's the hero of the film. Solid cast. Jennifer O'Neill, I mentioned. She and Norris have some decent scenes, but you have Ron O'Neill, Clue Gulager, Skypoint, Pepe Serna, who I've loved since Car Wash. Eric Laneville, who I know from Black Belt Jones. There's also another kickboxer. Bill Superfoot Wallace plays Norris's nemesis in the ring, and then there's a plot point which I won't give away. But it felt like a prestige, like a police ensemble, especially when you have actors of that level, and they just kind of wedged the martial arts in. It is kind of TV movie level look, and it's PG, so the violence isn't that much. There's a lot of slow-mo in a climactic fight between Norris and Wallace, which also becomes a plot point. It's an oddity. It's okay, but that one's better compared to The Octagon, the follow-up to this. And by the way, I mentioned The Octagon. You have to check out Golan Globus's treatment of The Octagon. And because I heard that, it made me giggle watching the film The Octagon. This week, of course, Golan Globus Theater is doing the Arnold Schwarzenegger film Raw Deal. So I remember seeing that in the theater. Norris is a gentleman whose past is coming back to haunt him. There are a series of terrorist attacks going on in the world. And we find out along the way that there is a worldwide terrorist group of ninjas being trained, and their big fight facility, the title of the film. And so the buildup of Chuck investigating what's going on with these terrorist attacks, and then realizing it's somebody from his past, a boyhood friend now turned a nemesis. And the thing that just, and it happens through the first two-thirds of the film, and I haven't listened to the commentary track yet. I will get to it. And thanks again, Golan Globus, for bringing this to my attention. But there's a lot of Chuck Norris whispering when thinking about his past. And it's really silly. It's very silly. I don't know. I can't wait to hear the explanation. I hope there's an explanation for this, but yeah, I mean, the ninja fight scenes that don't involve Norris are they're all right. And then we get to a climactic scene with grenades and fighting and swords, and it doesn't quite hit it all the way. So, and it's interesting to see these films because martial art films are still new to the U.S. audience in the late 70s, early 80s. As I mentioned, I think he really starts to hit his Chuck Norris starts his apex with a couple of films, Lone Wolf McQuaid, which is kind of a modern Western, and Code of Silence, but we're not there yet. So, Lee Van Cleef is in this one. Lee Van Cleef has a little more energy in this than he does in his average late 70s, early 80s cameo. So, also out on Kino Lorber, another canon film called Mercenary Fighters. Another, you hear the cliche of the ragtag group of misfits that are kind of put together. This is a dirty half dozen of sorts. You have the leader of the mercenary group for hire is Peter Fonda, with a really long hair and a ponytail and a walking stick. And he brings out the likes of Ron O'Neill, again, as the helicopter pilot and the plane pilot. Reb Brown, in full Reb Brown mode. James Mitchum is in this. And they're supposed to go to an African country to help squash a revolution with their corrupt president. And first off, there's sound glitches in this film. This is the final product, and there's sound glitches. Again, I don't think there's a commentary track on this. I won't hear how it went, but you can hear the sound difference. And of course, the first time it happens, I thought there was something wrong with my player. It is not my player. It is this film. So we have this group of mercenaries going to a third world African country, shot in Southern California, and And along the way, we see the training, and they're sort of getting along and sort of not getting along. the film score is basically two electronic instruments, so that's going to be in your brain. And about halfway through the film, the mission takes a halt, so Reb Brown's character can fall for a neutral political nurse who is helping tend to the village that the guys are hired to squash. And so it kind of turns into Reb's film for a while with this actress who plays the nurse. And then we get into the bonkers fight scene, explosions, screaming, heel turns between the group. It's kind of a mess, but it's a funny mess. This is definitely beer and pizza mess with a flawed film score. So, Mercenary Fighters, another Golden Globus film. Hopefully, I'm wondering if the Golden Globus guys will be discussing that one. Probably one of the surprise films in my watching of the last week is a 1967 action film, and this is a low budget action film, even though it's shot on location in Hong Kong, called Kill a Dragon, and it stars Jack Palance, Fernando Lamas, and Aldo Ray. Palance is a soldier of fortune who is hired by a small people from the village. I don't want to say the village people. To help bring nitroglycerin to their village, although it's being oversought by a crime lord played by Fernando Lamas. And Aldo Ray plays Palance's buddy who helps out. There's another ragtag group of weirdos that help out Palance in distracting the bad guys and trying to get the delivery into the village. And this is a film that came out in 1967. It's the same year as Bonnie and Clyde. I mention that because the violence in Kill a Dragon, there's no bloodshed, there's no slow motion. You know, these were the kind of action films that Arthur Penn and Sam Peckinpah were rebelling against by showing the brutality of violence on screen. And so I could see how this film would be dismissed at the time of its release. But now, in 2022, watching it with pizza and beer, it's not bad. It's not bad. If I find out that United Artists put this on a double bill with the Burt Reynolds, Sergio Carbucci Western Navajo Joe, and I thought, that's a decent 3 hours. That's a decent double feature at the movies with beer and pizza. Did I mention beer and pizza? Okay. It's directed by Michael Moore. No, not him. But other credits go by Michael D. Moore, who I found out was an AD on several Elvis movies and then got to direct an Elvis movie of his own, the 1965 inferior Paradise Hawaiian Style, the film that's not Blue Hawaii. So he also directed the one and only starring vehicle for Roy Orbison, The Fastest Guitar Alive. Take that for what it's worth. But Ray... Jack Palance and Fernando Lamas have a just casual, comfortable, cool performances with the two of them. They have a couple of scenes together, and this could have easily been scenery chewing by both of them, and it isn't. There's again a casual coolness that I like to both of those performances, as well as Aldo Ray. But yeah, it worked out all right. There's a whimsical feel to a climatic shootout and a village and a crime lord in nitroglycerin. So, and a funny use of miniatures at the end. So yeah, this was, I think this was one of those, if it's a rainy afternoon and it's on your TV, you stay in for that. So yeah, I recommend Kill a Dragon from 1967 on Kino Lorber Studio Classics. Also from Kino Lorber, also from Canon, Sylvia Crystal as Mata Hari. Okay. young, film goers. I was of an age where Sylvia Crystal films were kind of an event because of the three Emmanuel films she starred in. And there are a slew of knockoffs, but there's only three that she did. Emmanuel, Emmanuel 2, and Goodbye Emmanuel, for those who are keeping score. And then she appeared in some kind of horny teenager movies like, My Chauffeur and Private Lessons. And then she did a couple of films for Canon. This is the second one. The other one was the film version of Lady Chatterley's Lovers. And in this one, yes, she plays the Dutch bombshell, plays the famous double agent Mata Hari, who is played in this film is kind of a victim. Maybe because she's the protagonist in the film. There is a love triangle between her, a Frenchman, and a German who were buddies before the war breaks out in World War I. And then we see her interacting with the German side and the French side. But yeah, more as a victim and being manipulated by the German army and the French army. And I'm sorry, that's a big no. Here's the thing. So, and there's a few scenes, there are a couple of bedroom scenes, one with a man, one with a woman, that go on a little longer than your average film from the 1980s. And a major studio would have neutered a Mata Hari film. You know, I will say from a production value, this film is able to find castles and use of the countryside to make it look bigger. And that's what you do with smart production designers and directors as far as filmmaking. But the acting is, well, you don't go for Sylvia Kristel's acting. That's terrible, but it's kind of true. You're not seeing her do Macbeth anytime soon. There's quite a bit of skin in this, and I think that's kind of why you go, but because it's gussied up in a World War I espionage thriller, just like Lady Chatterley's Lover, was based on classic literature. Just because you can make a Mata Hari film doesn't necessarily mean you should. But yeah, you could get better actors from a bigger budget, but you would get less skin, and quite honestly, probably less people will go see it. So take that for what that's worth. But yeah, Mata Hari from Kino Lorber from Canon in the 1985, I believe. Shifting gears, because that's what I love doing with older titles, from 1960, also from Kino Lorber, Studio Classics, The Trials of Oscar Wilde, which stars Peter Finch as Oscar Wilde. Anytime I can find Peter Finch films that I haven't seen, because obviously we know him so well as Howard Beale in Network, you know, his posthumous Academy Award-winning performance. But yeah, he plays Wilde and plays him well as the famed Irish playwright and poet and writer and rapscallion is a way of putting it. And for a film in 1960, they address, there is a famous libel suit that he is involved in about his promiscuousness with a young man, the son of a lord, which doesn't go over well. Of course, in this film, Wilde is married and has two kids. And so seeing Peter Finch glide through the show and be a wordsmith is my favorite part of this film. And it takes a while before we get to the title of the film. The Lord Queensberry is barred from an event, and this is the one whose son is hanging out with Oscar. And, you know, we about halfway through the film, we get to the court. We get James Mason as the rival lawyer. Watching the two of them in a courtroom scene is fun. It's not as electrifying as Inherit the Wind. Not as good a director as Stanley Kramer. But the second hour of the film kind of gets bogged down because of the trial and the aftermath of what happens, of Wilde being shunned by mainstream society, the guy actually having to do jail time, the melodramatic final quarter when he gets out and there's illness and there's death. And yeah, so it's not perfect, but you go for Peter Finch. So, yeah, look for The Trials of Oscar Wilde from 1960 on Kino Lorber Studio Classics. And finally, from 1973, and this has been a while since I'd watched this, and I'm glad I did, Electra Glide in Blue, starring Robert Blake as a motorcycle cop who wants to be a detective. This is the Arizona State, way out in the Arizona desert. This was, or as the tagline likes to put it, a 5'4" man in a 6'2" world. But apparently Blake was 5'2" in real life. I'm 5'5". I can relate. But there's the whole aspect of Blake has his own, he plays John Wintergreen, you know, a motorcycle cop who's got his own code of ethics. And he is doing his job as far as pulling people over, trying to be fair. His motorcycle partner is a little more on the corrupt side, bending his rules to his own way, making people squirm. But Winter Green is more fair and balanced. I use that term with tongue in cheek. And then there's a moment where there what appears to be a suicide, Wintergreen thinks is a homicide and gets into it with his superiors and trying to investigate what is happening there. There's also an interesting and because of his calculations, he winds up being the driver for the investigating detective on the story, which means he gets out of his motorcycle garb and is able to put on what he's always wanted, the brown suit, the cowboy boots, the Stetson, you know, and dress as a police detective. Now, he's driving the main guy, but he's a part of it. And once he gets a taste of that, he wants to get in. He wants to into that world no matter what. In a way, it's kind of the flip side of Easy Rider, and it has a very similar ending to Easy Rider. Sorry if I'm blowing the ending for you. But he's, like I said, he's got his own code, and he's trying to stick with it. And something to be said about this. This isn't Dirty Harry, and I would be intrigued to see the Easy Rider crowd watch this film. It looks great. It's shot in Arizona. It's the great Conrad Hall is the cinematographer on this, one of his earlier films. And according to legend, the director, who also was a producer for the band Chicago, and some of the members of Chicago have small roles in this film, which is an oddity in and of itself. But took his salary and put it back into the pot so he could have Conrad Hall as cinematographer. And apparently they disagreed on the look of the film. The director wanted a John Ford Western feel, so you have all this gorgeous footage outside, but he gave Hall free rein on all of the interior shots. And some of them, they look cool and somehow mesh in. It doesn't seem distracting between the scope of the epic outside and these kind of really well-lit, intimate moments inside. It works out. But yeah, I don't know if cancel culture is going to watch this because Robert Blake is the star. But he's good in this. And there was that brief period before Beretta where he starred in a few films like this and Busting. So, but he's good. It works out. So, yeah, look for Electric Glide in Blue on Kino Lorber Studio Classics. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Okay, we'll go around the horn. And then we'll grab a pencil. Over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Now, this is a double feature. Don't Worry, Darling, and DC League of Super Pets. And if you've not read about what's been going on behind the scenes of Don't Worry, Darling, I don't know. Watch the film and then watch it. Screen 2, The Woman King and The Invitation. Screen 3, Barbarian and Top Gun Maverick. And Screen 4, Pearl and Fall. All of that is happening over at the Tibbs Drive-In. Over at the Skyline Drive-In this weekend is the Picture Show Weekend 2022. Oh my goodness. Friday, River's Edge, Big Bad Mama, Blood-Sucking Freaks, among others. Saturday, Ms. 45, Chesty Morgan film. Wow. The Barbarian Brothers, Rocky Horror Picture Show, Beyond the Darkness, Flesh Gordon, all of, wow. So anyway, for a full lineup, it's going to be busy at the Skyline. But yeah, check out Picture Show Weekend 2022, Bad Girls Go to Hell. Man, they find some old titles. Good on them for that. So yeah, check that out at the Skyline Drive-In in Shelbyville. Over at IU Cinema at 7 o'clock on Friday to the 23rd, Memoria from last year. That will be replayed on Saturday at 4 p.m. Saturday at 7 p.m., a biography of Lilith as well as the House of Science, a Museum of False Facts. Thursday, September 29th, cinema's first Nasty Women, Doubles and Doppelgangers, silent movie day with a newly restored, rarely seen international silent films highlighting feminine protest, slapstick rebellion, and gender play. That is happening Thursday the 29th. Friday the 30th, Maya Code at 7 p.m. And then Friday the 30th at 9 p.m., African Woman USA and My Brother's Wedding. Saturday, October 1st at 4 p.m., The Awful Truth with Cary Grant and Irene Dunne. And then Saturday, October 1st at 7 p.m. Behind Every Good Man and Pariah. All of that is happening at IU Cinema at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin tonight, Friday and Saturday, 2 and 7:30 p.m. Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince. Saturday, September 24th, Love Gilda. Saturday, the 24th at 10 a.m. Look for the documentary Love Gilda. Wednesday, September 28th, is a part of the Music Midwest movie series Repo Man from 1984. So, all of that is happening there. And then Saturday, October 1st, 2 and 7:30 p.m., Cinema Paradiso. All of that is happening at the Historic Art Craft Theater in Franklin. And as I mentioned, the Heartland Film Festival runs October 6th through the 16th. Go to heartlandfilms.org for all of that information. All right, grab a pencil. Let's find out what you've been watching this week. We start on Twitter with Russ, or as his handle is I Think, Therefore I Am, I Think. I watched Top Gun Maverick on my flight to London. The movie is very, very good, and I was completely meh about it when it first came out. I only decided to watch it after hearing from everyone I knew how good it is. All right, and enjoy London, Russ. That's great. Scott writes, Damien Omen 2 and Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark. Thank you, Scott. We move over to Facebook. Joshua writes, Morbius. Frank writes, a crazy horror film called Afterlife starring Justin Long, Christina Ricci, and Liam Neeson. Now, I've not seen that, Frank. I saw the trailer once, and I think, it looked fairly bonkers. So glad to hear it lives up to that. Chad writes, Vengeance. John writes, Ice Station Zebra. I think every submarine movie after this incorporated the hull is going to crush at this depth scene. Very good. Bestseller, 1987, James Woods, Brian Dennehy. Rembrandt, another great Charles Laughton role. He was so careful with his facial expressions, and he got to do great monologue speeches in this one. Would make a great play. And The Outfit. I went back through the 2022 archives to see if you'd mentioned this and couldn't find it. Sorry, I need to see it. Mark Rylance was really good in this, and so was the whole cast. Really liked it. Felt like a cross between Glengarry Glen Ross and Clue. I also think this would make a great play. Thank you, John. Lou Harry writes, Four Samosas, The Lost King, and Corsage. Taylor writes, The Girl in the Red Velvet Swing, Samaritan, The Spy Who Dumped Me, After the Thin Man, Travelin' Band, CCR at the Royal Albert Hall, that's a concert, Despicable Me 2, and The Gray Man, as well as Tokyo Joe and The Birdcage. Thank you, Taylor. Amanda went to the library, Hope and Glory, Molly's Game, and The Goodbye Girl. Eric, First View, A Walk in the Sun, and Elvis. And his rewatches, The Big Sleep, both the preview version and the theatrical release, both are great. A Bug's Life for the second time, and Lady and the Tramp for the second time. Matthew writes, Rear Window followed by Disturbia for a voyeuristic double feature. Man, good call, Matt. That's good. Eric Bryant, who is in Lysistrata with me, as usual, brings it every week. I got nothing. I know what you've been up to, Brian, Eric. It's okay. Gary writes, Wojciech Strzok, Nosferatu the Vampire. This is the Herzog version. He's on a Herzog kick. Hair and Do the Right Thing. David writes 2001, A Space Odyssey. Robert Muggy declares it's a slow week. A Woman is a Woman, Jean-Luc Godard, and Sweet Hours. So thank you, Robert. JJ writes, Goodnight Mommy on Amazon. Not worth it. See How They Run, Cute Whodunit, and a Michael Mann triple feature of Manhunter, Last of the Mohicans, and Heat. That's a lot of Michael Mann there, JJ. Magnus writes, Star Trek III, The Munsters, and The Invitation, deeming The Invitation okay, but nothing more. Manny writes, saw Owen Klein's Funny Pages last night. Oh, I'm glad you got to see that, Manny. Yeah, I hope you like that as much as I did. Phil writes Wrath of Man, A Quiet Place 2, and Dream Horse. Daniel writes Topsy Turvy, Europa Europa, and The First That's Entertainment. Jessica, who is also in Lysistrata with me, we open October 6th. From Within, Identity, Housebound, Malevolent, The Innkeepers, The Seventh Day, The Lazarus Project, Buckaroo Banzai, Come to Daddy, Night of the Demons, in the Shadow of the Moon. And she deemed it a busy week. Thank you, Jessica. Thank you, stage wife. Tom writes Radio Days, Reet, Petite, and Gone with Louis Jordan. Or Louis Jordan. Tony writes Lawrence of Arabia, Mad Max, Elektra, Sky Point to Irene Pappas, and Let the Right One In. Cassandra writes Avengers Affinity Wars. Molly writes Nobody, Death on the Nile, and On the Town. Hey, Kendall. Kendall chiming in for the first time. Very cool. Kendall writes Buck and the Preacher, which is now out on Criterion, Hurry Sundown, if anything else, Michael Caine with a Southern accent. And for Color Girls, When the Rainbow Isn't Enough. Thank you, Kendall. Good to see you, pal. Eric writes Morbius. Nancy writes The Good Boss and Memoria. Kevin writes The Eyes of Tammy Faye. Melissa writes Do Revenge. Austin Glidden, Medium Cool Podcast, On the Waterfront, Stardust Memories, and Paths of Glory. Casey declared, I watched a lot of Streetcars. Okay. Pat writes Clerks 3 and Don't Worry, Darling. Terry writes The Little Soldier and The Harder They Fall. Megan writes The American President and then said, yeah, I said it. And then I replied, I own it. And then she deemed it a mediocre classic. I think it's better than mediocre. It's an Aaron Sorkin rom-com. That's all. Always good dialogue. Devin writes Dear Evan Hansen. Kathleen writes Still Mine and the Bridges of Madison County. Helen writes House of Gucci and the Secret Lives of Bees. Sean writes Thor, Love and Thunder, as well as Alien. Lisa writes Colette, Falls Around Her, and Elsa and Fred. Gretchen writes Ken Burns, The U.S. and the Holocaust. Jeff writes Rome, Open City. Oh, man. And finally, Linda writes, Nothing On, Watched the U.S. and the Holocaust, Sad, We Suck. And that's the end of this week's Grab a Pencil list, gang. We will try again next week. Wow. Okay. All right, friends, some words to live by.
Silent breed is people!
Zardoz has spoken.
Go see a good movie. You deserve it. There's plenty out there. Please, let's never end Grab a Pencil like that again. Wow. Sorry. I'm sorry. I'm sorry, Linda. I don't mean the crap on you that much, but whew. Anyway, there you go. We'll try this again next week. Hopefully, we'll be having a couple of previews of some festivals coming up and some self-indulgence, like this podcast. Anyway, oh, and don't forget, Golden Globus, guys, it's Arnold Schwarzenegger's Raw Deal, so give that a listen. Thanks for listening. You're listening to Film Sociology, a film podcast here at WFYI.org. Good afternoon, Fort Myers. Good afternoon, California. Good afternoon, Michigan.
I can't believe you let her watch Manos. Is she scarred for life?
Let's put it this way.
What parent are you?
When I wake her up, I vocalize the theme to wake her up to get her ready to school.
Oh, you're a terrible father.
Okay. We'll do it live.
Okay.
We'll do it live!